Welcome to Reformed Rakes, a historical romance podcast that will tease you from beyond the grave. I'm Emma, a law librarian writing about justice and romance at the Substack Restorative Romance.
My name is Chels. I'm the writer of the romance Substack The Loose Cravat, a romance book collector, and a book talker under the username Chels_ebooks.
I'm Beth, and I'm a grad student, and I'm on Book Talk under the name Beth Hammond Reads.
How do I describe an Anne Mallory book? For me, Mallory is an author that I let get away with almost anything. Quirks and peccadillos that would cause me to DNF another book, I not only tolerate in an Anne Mallory book, I relish and enjoy. Currently on hiatus from writing historical romance, Mallory has written 11 historical romances. Her books are often genre hybrids, with a mystery plot as an undercurrent with the romance. The books are regencies, an edge towards the wallpaper line, with a few historical inaccuracies, almost dollhouse-like settings, and sometimes some incomprehensible world-building. But what makes Anne Mallory sing for me is her relationships and the chemistry between the couples. When I read One Night is Never Enough, my favorite Mallory, the first time the couple had sex, I went back and reread it from the beginning because I was convinced they had already had sex. That's how charged I thought the relationship was. These books are not expressly more explicit or quote-unquote spicier. How Mallory creates her tension is through character work and small moments of intimacy. I frequently lose track of what a Mallory character looks like. I find she tends to emphasize not what bodies look like, but where they are and what they're doing. So it makes sense to me that Mallory, an author less interested in the image of a body, writes a romance where one of the characters, for most of the book, does not have a body. In the words of Chels, For the Earl's Pleasure is the classic childhood friends to enemies, to one of us is a ghost, to lover trope. For the Earl's Pleasure is a mystery romance hybrid as we try to uncover what led to Valerian Lord Rainwood's attempted murder, which now has him unconscious in an undisclosed location. But luckily for Valerian, the object of his longtime teasing and bullying, Abigail Smart, has a gift. She can see ghosts, and while Valerian is unconscious, he appears to Abigail. I can honestly say I've never quite read a book like this. So before we do our plot summary, do you have any thoughts about what makes Anne Mallory special?
Yeah, I've read a lot of Histrom, and I think Anne Mallory has a style that's just like utterly unique. Like if she were to write a new historical and I did a blind read, I think I would be able to guess that it was Mallory. Her worlds tend to feel a little gritty and dreamlike, and I'm not just saying that because this is a paranormal. Like Three Nights of Sin feels the most like a noir out of any historical romance I've read. That's another book of hers. Speaking of that book, one of my favorite things about Mallory is how she writes men, actually. I know a lot of people think that historical romance authors writing heterosexual couples write men as more interesting by default. I disagree with this. I think people just say that because they're overly critical of women characters. But the men in her books are a particular strength in that, like, for all their wealth, attractiveness, what have you, they can't be used as a shortcut for a general romance archetype. Like, her spoiled heir to a dukedom isn't going to be like anybody else's. Her grumpy crime lord isn't going to be like anybody else's.
I kind of love Anne Mallory for the fact that she is playing with genre. I feel like current histrom feels too much like four tropes in a trench coat type of scenario. Where you could see she is really purposely trying to, like, pull from different genres and be like, how would this work if I, like, had this paranormal aspect and mystery and this, like, these friends who are no longer friends, but they're obviously still in love with each other. It's a story. So I love that. And I agree with Chels. Like, I think you could just hand me a manuscript and I would be like, is this Anne Mallory?
Nobody really writes like her. I look, one of the things I love about her, which I think maybe to a detriment to other people, but I'm trying to pitch Anne Mallory to people. Her books take a lot of effort to read, which is not necessarily a selling point for a lot of historical romance. Like, I think a lot of people approach romance as like, oh, this is like a fun romp. It's going to be an easy read. But I feel like you have to really pay attention to Anne Mallory. I think our listeners will see this when they hear the plot description. This book has a lot of plot in it that doesn't always make sense. But this also manifests in like her dialogue. Like, I think her conversations sometimes can be hard to track. And I think initially I was frustrated with this, but then I realized, like, is it a sin for me to have to pay attention closely to a book? Mm-hmm. I was so charmed by Mallory that I landed on no, that it's like, if the book demands my attention and I am compelled to give it to it, that's only a good thing. And so I think that's one of the reasons why I'll tolerate some of these sort of quirks. And like, she does have like historical inaccuracies that sometimes, like, some of the language is wrong. Like, I think she refers to like dukes with the wrong title sometimes and that sort of thing. But I tolerate it because I'm so charmed by how she writes characters.
I feel like another thing about her is she doesn't like over explain things. Like in her writing style, she's very rarely like telling you something. She's mostly just like showing like a dialogue scene or like an action. Like she very rarely stops and is like, by the way, reader, this is like important, or like over explains something, which is why I think her plots are so hard to follow, because she does not want to like hold your hand. She just is like, all right, let's go.
Like when I was writing the plot summary, I kept having to say like, this character references this plot point rather than this thing happens. Like a character will say something and like, if you've been paying attention, you will know what that means. But when I've been writing the plot summary and like I parsed down what happened, I'm like, I can't just say that this thing happened, because it didn't just happen. Someone's like obliquely referencing it and you have to put the pieces together. So it does work as a mystery because you really don't know what's going on. Okay, I'll do a plot summary. So hold tight, listeners. A lot happens. And if you don't follow the end of it, it's okay. Just go on vibes.
Yeah.
As an eligible earl, Valerian Danford, Lord Rainwood, is in the in-group of the Tahn, and Abigail Smart is held to a second social tier. Her family has money, but no social standing. They have a history of trading barbs at social events, but usually quietly in corners, so no one seems to suspect that her animus stemming from some childhood spat. Least of all, Abigail's social climbing mother and their escort, Mrs. Browning, hired to procure introductions to help Abigail get a marriage proposal. Their social groups meet at a ball, and they trade barbs. There are rumors of a corruption list circulating the Tahn, which has the names of families who are mad, secret mental illness that everyone would rather not be announced to the Tahn. Abigail provokes Valerian, and he speaks quietly to her with contempt, referencing her mother's social climbing and Abigail's spirit. As he's leaving a club after the ball, suddenly both Valerian and his friend Templing are knocked over the head on the street and pass out. A few days later, Abigail is in her drawing room, watching a couple have sex. The couple's a pair of ghosts, a maid and a footman. Abigail can see spirits. They tend to ignore her and go about their ghostly business. She's had this power for years and usually attempts to ignore them back, but can find her mind wandering. Abigail has few options for suitors, but she's consumed with hiding her secret that she worries could lead to incarceration in an asylum. Later that night, at a ball at his home, Valerian is trying to get someone's attention. In the ballroom, he sees Abigail, and unlike everyone else, she can see him. She realizes this must mean he's dead, but he speaks to her, demanding and then rejecting her offered explanation. She remembers his words when they were younger, quote, "You are mad, never speak to me again." She implores to him, "Deal with this on your own." Valerian has to reconcile that some of Abigail's odd behavior that he's noticed over her years of watching her might be explained by her ability to see ghosts. He tries to speak to anyone else and cannot. When Abigail leaves the party, he struggles to leave the house, hitting a force field at the door, but then with great concentration, he's able to think of Abigail, and he arrives in her carriage, along with her mother and Mrs. Browning. Mrs. Smart's anxiety about Abigail's odd behavior increases as she begs off that evening with a headache. When she retires to her room, Valerian follows, and Abigail begrudgingly attempts to explain what is happening. He is a spirit, and he has stayed here possibly because of some unfinished business. But Valerian insists he doesn't feel dead. Abigail's maid, Telly, joins them. She knows about Abigail's gift and treats Abigail reverently for it. Abigail tries to encourage Valerian to let go from whatever he's holding onto in life, or at least go haunt something that might actually occupy his thoughts, but he assures her that she would absolutely be the person he would haunt, if he were actually dead. She goes to sleep, and he's anxious to stay near her, in part because her presence seems to ground him, help his mental capacities. When she wakes, she learns that Valerian can't see her other ghosts that occupy her house, which suggests he may not be dead, despite being a spirit in her presence. Abigail has to prepare for her suitor, so Valerian sees just how her mother and Mrs. Browning speak to her, and he's offended on her behalf. He witnesses the suitor visit Abigail and expresses both his current distaste for the man and the idea that he had gotten rid of the man weeks ago. At every subsequent interaction with a suitor that day, Valerian is in Abigail's ear giving commentary on the unsuitability of the man for Abigail. On the final match of the day, Abigail and her suitor go for a walk in the park with Valerian tagging along. Valerian slips up, and one of his comments confirms to Abigail that he's seen the corruption list with the name of mad individuals on it. Later, when they are fighting about his behavior during the day, Valerian suddenly disappears from Abigail's sight. He wakes up somewhere in great pain and hears men talking about him, but quickly passes back out, but does not immediately return to Abigail. In an effort to find him, Abigail solicits a visit with Valerian's dragon of a grandmother, the Dowager Duchess, who speaks to Abigail with contempt. There, Abigail sees Valerian's younger brother, Lord Basil. When Abigail listens to the anodyne conversations, Ghost Valerian walks in and his defenses are down over his relief of seeing Abigail again. He approaches her directly, with little consideration of others in the room or how Abigail's reaction will be interpreted. In a sort of haze, he's able to touch her, and this time it is something between a ghostly non-touch and a corporeal solid one. Abigail tries to keep up conversation, and it seems to endear her to Lord Basil, despite her awkwardness at the visit, which helps stave off commentary from her mother and Mrs. Browning, though Valerian is furious at the idea of his younger brother courting Abigail. Back at home, they discuss his ghostly state. Valerian wants Abigail to break into the home of Templing, the man who was kidnapped with Valerian, to look for clues or another possible ghost. He cannot go by himself because his ghostly form does not allow him to move voluntarily without Abigail. They're able to get into the office of Templing's home and find his ledger after sneaking away from a ball nearby. Abigail takes the ledger and hides it in the garden of the ball, but Mrs. Browning finds her, slightly disheveled. A group of young men, including Lord Basil and Gregory, one of Abigail's friends, volunteer a lie for her that she had been with them in the garden, only for Valerian and Abigail to realize the ledger they stole is missing from their hiding place. When they return home, the Smarts' household had been ransacked. Valerian interprets this as Abigail in danger for her investigation, and he wants her to outsource it. But she's hesitant to tell anyone anything for fear of revealing her gift and ending up in an asylum or being disbelieved, like how Valerian did not believe her when they were children. In their squabble, Valerian calls Abigail her childhood nickname, Abby, which spurs her to think of him more affectionately and try to help him without revealing her gift to anyone. Rather than tell anyone anything, Abigail wants to go to the gaming hell where Valerian last was. Telly helps Abigail get a footman's outfit and accompanies her to the hell. When Abigail is outside the building, Valerian is able to walk inside the hell. He recognizes men who were there the night he and Templing were attacked. They speak about getting paid for the attack and start to leave. Valerian cannot follow without Abigail, so they get into a carriage and follow to a fancy neighborhood, only to realize the men are going to Valerian's younger brother's house. Valerian thinks this means that Basil has had him kidnapped. The next day, while on an outing with the suitor, Abigail's reticule is stolen. She chases after the thief herself, and it is revealed as a trap. The men know that Abigail was at the hell and want to know why. Valerian, unable to help, implores her to reveal anything that will save her, but her partial truths that keep a ghost involvement out of the story are unsatisfactory. When they seem like they're going to hurt her, Valerian rears back and punches one of them in the face, giving Abigail a moment to get away, but then Valerian disappears again. Valerian wakes back up where he's kept to the sound of screams, but he quickly passes out once more. Abigail uses the same method to find him again by going to her grandmother's house. This time when he shows up, his touches feel even more real. Valerian does not want Abigail to entertain Basil's advances, fearing that he is the one who hired the men to hurt Abigail. When they get back to Abigail's bedroom, Valerian can't stop touching her. It seems to ground his memories and thought processes. They try to figure out where he's being held. Valerian knows it's not Bedlam, though they can't be sure of the location. Valerian remembers a street sign. They ask Telly to look through London for options of what he might see. They attend a ball together, and without Valerian's earthly presence keeping them at bay, the men of the town seem distinctly interested in Abigail, much to Valerian's dismay. She dances with Mr. Campbell, one of Valerian's friends, and this also raises the ire of Gregory, which makes Valerian suspicious of Gregory's involvement. Back in Abigail's bedroom, spurred by Campbell's expressing interest in Abigail, Valerian finally kisses Abigail. They fumble through the rules of his ghostly status, realizing that while he can touch her, he can't touch her clothing for very long, reminding them both of his in-between state. Telly interrupts, and when she leaves, Abigail and Valerian discuss what to do. Valerian makes a quip about the importance of lineage, and Abigail calls him on his fixation with it. He often uses it as a compliment or an insult, and he brushes this away. Abigail begs off to bed, and Valerian keeps watch. The next morning, Abigail wakes and Valerian is missing, but she assumes he's exploring the house. One of Abigail's ghost friends, who always repeats herself, is suddenly out of sorts and saying new information, indicating something is amiss. Valerian arrives and tells Abigail they must go, a man is here for her. He describes him to Abigail and she immediately recognizes the man as a charlatan doctor who her mother previously used for treatments of Abigail. Abigail is terrified of the doctor, but her mother insists Abigail will feel better if she's rid of her curse. Abigail had told her mother that the previous intervention had worked in order to stop them, but now her mother knows she's been lying. The doctor enters Abigail's bedroom. He references not being able to give Abigail the full treatment, but is now looking forward to it. It's clear that this man sexually abuses girls whose families think they are crazy. The man has a liquid that disappears ghost, which he had previously used on a ghost friend of Abigail's, and is now trying to use on Valerian. The doctor's threats make it seem like people have been working against Abigail, but she has no idea who would take that interest in her. Valerian is able to shove the man's head against the wall, but he disappears again, with Abigail thinking the liquid has landed on him. Valerian wakes up in Abigail's cellar and hears her screaming. He's able to find Abigail standing up to her mother, insisting she will never be treated by the doctor. The doctor is removed, and Valerian slips back into Abigail's room. She's overjoyed to see him and tells him of the doctor's treatment, which stops short just of raping her. Abigail wonders how Valerian did not get transported back to his own home like before. Valerian thinks about how he thought of home, but had pictured Abigail's face. This causes him to be glib with her to cover his emotions. They leave to go look for signs that match Valerian's description of what he saw at the window, but find no buildings across the street that could be where he is held. The next day is the day of Abigail and Basil's outing, and Valerian is nervous for it, and Abigail tries to assuage him. She nervously plays with a brush on her nightstand, and Valerian meaningfully recognizes it as a birthday gift he bought for her when he was away at Eton that resulted in mockery from his friends. But he gifted it anyway and had bought her a magic comb later, though they had a falling out before he could give that to her. Abigail asks Valerian to touch her, and they fumble through the mechanics of a ghost hookup. The next morning, she finds a pub that matches the description of Valerian's sign, but has to get back for her outing with Basil. They're going to go watch a hobby horse race in the park. The men who have been interested in Abigail vie for her attention, annoying Valerian to no end. During the race, as retaliation for her attentions on other men, he seduces her in the park, unseen to everybody else. While Abigail is conversing with Basil, he reveals that Campbell has been staying with him. This piques their suspicion. The men who went to Basil's house could have been going to see Campbell. Valerian is suspicious of Campbell, so that night they break into Basil's house to look through Basil and Campbell's documents. They find a detailed accounting of Valerian's whereabouts, notes about the ransacking of Abigail's house, and the ledger that was taken from the garden. They interpret this to mean that Basil was looking for Valerian, rather than responsible for his being missing, and that he suspected Abigail's involvement, hence his new interest in her. They overhear Basil asking a drunken Campbell about the disappearance of Valerian, and Campbell reveals some hints that he's involved, based on his debts being paid. Basil leaves, but drunken Campbell sees Abigail. She has to convince him that it's all a dream. Campbell speaks openly about his desire to marry her, to one-up Valerian. Abigail pulls off the trick and is able to leave the house. But in the street is the doctor and Sir Walter, the father of the woman that Valerian is supposed to soon be engaged to. The doctor yells thief, and Sir Walter helps him stop Abigail and turns her over to the doctor. The doctor recognizes Abigail and threatens her. She knees him, he doubles over, and she's able to escape. While they're safely back in her room, Valerian is able to bring up memories of their parting. He hates how much he's become like his late older brother now, but Abigail insists the boy she loved was not like his terrible brother. They are intimate again and seem on the verge of admitting their love for each other. Valerian wakes with hesitations. The same issues that plagued their alive relationship plague it now. Abigail's family are social climbers. He's nearly betrothed to another woman, and he still acutely feels what he perceived as a betrayal years ago. When Abigail wakes, her mother visits and lets her know that the charlatan doctor has been permanently dismissed. She tries to explain her reasoning behind the treatment. As a girl, she also saw spirits. She discusses with Abigail the length that she had gone to climb the Tawn. She used her knowledge of a family of ghosts, the Smarts, to create a false identity. Abigail's father was a middle-class man whose investments paid off. So they are very wealthy, but has no entry into the Tawn. When he died, his wife took on a new, higher-class identity. Abigail's mother was sexually abused by the doctor's father as a treatment. Abigail is able to see her mother with new compassion now, though she's still angry that her mother would let the same treatment even come close to her daughter. Abigail realizes that Valerian has been listening, though she's not sure how much he's heard. Mrs. Smart leaves, and Abigail avoids Valerian's glances and remembers the day of their falling out. Abigail had been waiting for Valerian in a copse near his home, though when Thornton, the older brother, approached her. He references her ability to see him and demands help. Valerian arrives, and she does not realize that he cannot see Thornton. Valerian is trying to tell her about the accident they were in that caused Thornton's death. But Abigail does not understand, because she does not yet realize that Thornton is dead. Ghost Thornton is openly saying cruel things to Valerian, so Abigail has the courage to stand up to him. But Valerian interprets her comments as directed at him, that he would be a bad earl, that he would never live up to his brother. Combined with this perceived cruelty and his father and grandmother insisting that Abigail is no longer a suitable companion for the heir to a dukedom, Valerian quickly cuts her out. Thornton's ghost is the first of many for Abigail, and the sudden severance with her best friend does generally drive her mad in these circumstances. Returning to the present, Valerian is not angry with Abigail, but was relieved to know the truth about her past. He asks her about the corruption list, but he admits he burned it once he saw her name on it, even before he knew the circumstances that would place her on there. At somehow another ball, Abigail has a private conversation with one of her friends that he nervously reveals that he's the one who knocked out Valerian in Templing, looking for the corruption list, worried about his own family's presence on it, though he never found it. Abigail thinks he's just one part of the plan, not involved in the actual kidnapping. While arguing about what to do, Valerian disappears again, but he's able to return that night directly to Abigail with more information about where he is. Valerian also follows Abigail's maid, Telly, outside, and realizes that she's been passing information about Abigail's state to a lover and does not actually believe that Abigail sees ghosts. He keeps Abigail from revealing any further plan to Telly. They go to where Valerian is being held and look for his body. Valerian's spirit is reunited with his body, and he wakes up in great pain. Abigail is taken by cronies and finds out that the person behind the scheme is Sir Walter, the father of Valerian's almost fiance. He's been conducting experiments on residents of asylum under the guise of charity work. He also knows about Abigail's gift, so he's interested in Valerian twofold because he knows Valerian will bring him to her. The doctor has become a close confidant, and Sir Walter's also subsidizing Mrs. Browning as an informant on the Smarts. Abigail was right that her friend was an unknowing pawn in the scheme. Valerian is also able to break his confines and find a gun to subdue Sir Walter's threats. While weighing their options, a patient at the asylum stabs Sir Walter with a pair of scissors. Abigail is able to get Valerian out on the street into a cab. In the next few days, it is the talk of the town that the Smarts are interlopers. Abigail overhears the gossip in a store and assumes Valerian betrayed her secret. Despite him still being in recovery, she insists on seeing him and asks why her background is now common knowledge, though he was the only one who knew. His grandmother is there and slips up and reveals she investigated the Smarts' past and spread the rumor herself. Valerian stands up to his grandmother and proposes to Abigail. So, This is the only paranormal romance that I think I've ever read. I know both of you have more experience with the genre than I do. How does this compare? I'm specifically interested in the ghost mechanics, which are more appealing to me in a book than paranormals that get closer to monster romance, like vampires or werewolves. Have you read other ghost romances before, and is something shared between this one and those?
There's one J.R. Ward book in the Black Dagger Brotherhood. It's like a vampire paranormal series from like the mid-aughts. Well, I think it's actually went on for a long time, if it's not still going. But one of the early ones ends with the heroine being a ghost. And I think the ending is very polarizing from what I understand. It's not quite similar, because I think that she can kind of still do a lot of the same tasks in her ghost form than she could as a human. There's also, like, you remember that kind of like famous cover where you move it and the ghost appears, Everlastin'? I haven't read that one, but like I know that one's a ghost romance and everybody buys it for the crazy cover. But I guess as far as this book goes, I think there's a lot of thematic and structural similarities in For the Earl's Pleasure with like paranormals that have vampires, demons, gods and goddesses, specifically around like kind of trying to cheat death. Like in the paranormals that were very popular in like the late 90s, early 2000s, you might have a character that's immortal, but they have that one person who they have to rely on to make living bearable. This is kind of what Abigail is doing for Valerian. He's stuck in limbo and has three options, like solving the mystery and finding his body, living as a ghost for an indeterminate amount of time, or dying permanently. And that like cheating permanent death is something that's like huge with paranormals.
Yeah, I don't feel like there's as many like, in like the supernatural paranormal genre, there's not as many ghost romances. And maybe it's because they has to kind of follow the same beats of like either find the body and that person comes back to life. I think specifically for this book, what I found just kind of like in general between paranormal romances that I've read is Mallory, it's not as all-consuming as like some of like the heavier paranormals I've read, but it's also like the paranormal element is integrated really well into the romance. Like you could not take out Abigail, like
being able to see spirits or
her background, and it would like massively change the book, like if you changed those elements. Whereas I feel some, I'm going to particularly come for the trend of like cozy witch books. The supernatural elements in those books feel like really superficial. I feel like authors won't fully explore the ramifications of like the world they've built. Mm-hmm. One particular book I read, this very secret Society of Irregular Witches, and I liked it, but I don't know, like the author does some things with gender where it's like all witches are female, that it's just like was very essentialist and I don't think she really like thought through. And that there was like a curse only on the female line, that I was like, okay, but then why would people have kids if like when you have a child, a girl daughter, then you will die? Like, I don't know.
Maybe we should call cozy fantasy wallpaper fantasy.
Oh my gosh.
Like, seriously.
Devastating.
I feel like that book I read, though, she could have just been like a nanny, and I don't even know if you would have had to like change too much of the story to make it work. But with For the Earl's Pleasure, it definitely feels much more integrated.
Yeah, like you really couldn't do the book, because the whole point is that they're able to have this like intimacy with each other, because they're only seeing each other in the ton. And so that's the whole thing with Abigail and Valerian, is that they had this like continued like barb throwing relationship for years now, but it's always in public, in corners where like they don't want people to know that they have this distaste for each other, though of course lots of people notice. But finally they're able to be in a room together. Like I found myself when I was writing the plot summary, I frequently started paragraphs and was like, and then they're back in private, and then they're back in. Right. So it's like they're always like structured around these moments where they just couldn't be together alone. And I think that's also one of the things that makes it distinct from a lot of historical romance, is that's the kind of thing. Like a couple being alone together frequently only happens after a big declaration or after a big like sort of moment or lots of like sort of trials and tribulations to get to the part where they're sneaking around together or they're engaged. It's like this happens very early in their relationship. So it's able to be like structured differently than even a lot of its like historical romance peers. I will say I do love ghost romances as movies. Like this is one of my favorite genres of movies. And I wish that more people would write, because I mostly want to read historical romance. I want more historical romance ghost stories. One of my favorite historical romances, or my favorite ghost romance of all time, is actually a historical romance. It's The Ghost of Mrs. Muir, which is from the 1940s, which does remind me of this a lot. Like sort of she's the only one who can see him. they don't have a past like Abigail and Valerian do, but I think it's the intimacy is structured very similarly, though that movie is different because they can't touch each other. And so it's kind of this clever way to get around censorship in the 1940s, is they have this like very charged relationship, and it's almost able to be like more charged because you know they're not going to touch each other. So they have this like insane chemistry that is not, doesn't need to be censored at all because they're never like bodily interacting. But yeah, this is just me. This is my pitch for more ghost Regencies. I would read all of them.
I feel like it works really well though, because like if you have a budget, like an actor being a ghost, you just have to have someone walk through them once or twice. Right. Maybe like walk through a wall. But like most of the time it's just like everyone in that room ignoring that one person.
Yeah.
Right? Like
It's so fun. It's a big trend in the 1940s. I think as a outpouring of sort of like World War II is sort of the reason that people argue it, is that sort of after all this death, people want to see people come back from the dead or have like this sort of like ghostly presence on Earth. So some of them, they get a happily ever after in heaven, or sometimes the people are able to like occupy another body and come back. But it's whole this whole little mini genre in the 1940s that I love. That I'm always seeking ghost romances, and I would like more of them in historical romance novels. Okay, so continuing with ghost. So I think there's some aspects of his ghost identity that I think make for interesting structural elements in the romance, which I think we kind of already touched on. First off, it's a temporary and exclusively perceived by Abigail. Secondly, unlike something like a vampire or werewolf romance, Valerian is not in community with other ghosts, which I thought was interesting, because I think that's often a sense of or a strong part of paranormal romance. Like there's a werewolf community or a vampire community that the non-paranormal person has to deal with. I think this changes the arc of the romance. Abigail's the one who knows about ghosts, mostly as a viewer. She learns the rules through observation, but Valerian is the one who is a ghost. Mallory's world building is sometimes what gets away with her in her more earthly bound books. But we talked about this as we were reading it, that this almost seems to ground her in creating a structure around like what is happening in the book. So why do you think that works so well?
Yeah, Mallory is withholding a lot of information that both Abigail and Valerian know, like namely the cause of the fallout between them and what happened to Valerian's older brother. She also withholds like what happened to Abigail to make her so afraid of being discovered. So as you're reading, the questions keep like building and building, and you kind of have to do like what you're saying earlier is like pay attention. But the emotional aspect of a later reveal is much greater, in my opinion. So it's kind of important that you aren't like firmly oriented in the world and what's going on. Like your lack of knowledge is going to kind of help with some of the payoff in the end. Neither Abigail or Valerian really know what's going on with Valerian, actually. So, like, Abigail is familiar with spirits, but Valerian isn't quite like the others. Like, he's not actually dead. He can remember their previous encounters, and he can follow Abigail around and touch her in a way that the other ghosts can't. So, for all of Abigail's expertise, they're really kind of at sea about what's happening. Because of this, it's so much easier to go along with them into the unknown, even though they're withholding a lot of information. We're all just figuring it out as we go. But in the meantime, let's let Valerian have a few tantrums.
Yeah, we spoke about this in the chat about like why this book seems to work a little bit better. And I feel like her other books, she has a series where it's like some vaguely sinister underworld character, but no one really knows what's going on. Like, I never know what those male characters are like doing in the underworld. I just know that they're supposed to be maybe kind of scary.
They're baddies.
But they're not actually that scary. But I feel like kind of what Charles was talking about, like how Mallory hangs on to information almost to the end, because it is structured like a mystery. But I feel like this really grounds her as well. Like, she's constantly answering questions and like, what are the limits of Abigail's abilities? Like, what are the repercussions of those abilities? Like, who knows what? Like, I think, yeah, this works a lot better for her. And then she set this during the Regency. Like, why would you set your ghost book during the Regency? And I think she has the why, where Emma kind of talked about earlier, where you have all these scenes where they can kind of be together, where it's like, they wouldn't have that type of interaction outside of like people watching them. Like, it would always be in a public space. So they could never kind of like reevaluate their relationship. So I feel like that world building really helps with like the why of the relationship and how it changes. And then there's a looming threat of her being thrown in an asylum. Like, we kind of talked about this earlier, where There's a very scary doctor character. So she's kind of like, her mom really wants her to get married, but if she gets married, then her husband might discover that she's kind of strange and he can throw in her asylum. But then, like, the doctor is just kind of like a looming character in the background because the mom still has ties to him, so he still comes to the house sometimes. So it's just like this ever-present threat. And it's not like people, obviously people still get institutionalized today, but I feel like it's a different flavor back in the mm-hmm. Regency.
Yeah, I was thinking about, as Chels was talking about, the second chance. So it's kind of a second chance because they're children when they first are like friends. But I think, so this, one of the reasons this works, I'm trying to remember if Mallory has written other second chance romances, but I think that withholding of information is one of the things that makes certain second chance romances work for me and others not. Like Sherry Thomas does that as well. And she loves a second chance romance where you don't know why the falling out happened or like what the details of it were until like much later in the book. And I think that tends to work better for me when the characters know something that the reader doesn't. I think so often in dual POVs, especially, the tension is between one character knowing something and the other character not. Mm-hmm. I like it when the reader doesn't know everything, too. And I think Mallory's interest in mystery plots sort of prepares her more to write a mystery among like emotions as well. It's just so good. So, yes, kind of a second chance romance. But also, I think most people would call this enemies to lovers. I realize we've definitely done books that are enemies to lovers. I don't know how often we talk about it in those terms because we're not really trope dudes. That's not how we talk about books. That's not how we like books. Just sort of categorically, it's not, I don't think any of us like sort of are trope forward readers. I personally don't find it particularly useful when determining whether I will like a book, but enemies to lovers is one of those popular buckets. It's big on how people talk about books. And sometimes there's discourse about what counts as enemies. I love, Chels has this line where they have said before about not assuming how low the stakes are for it to take them to form an enemy. Because sometimes people are like, you have to be like at war with each other to be enemies. And it's like, you've never had an office job.
Yeah, I feel like I've had an enemy at every office job I've ever worked.
You make and a I'm TikTok sure, enemy every day.
Right. But one thing, I don't think you could read this book and not think that they're enemies, because I love how mad Valerian is at Abigail. It's a relationship that in all visible markers, he is more powerful. He's an earl. He fits into the ton really nicely. He's a man. His group of friends really wonders why he has this fixation on Abigail to begin with, who is not quite a wallflower, but is definitely in like a second tier social group. But he is so upset with her by like the betrayal that he perceives that he holds this sort of like angry tundra for her for years. So what are your thoughts on this trope sort of at large? Is it really a trope? Sometimes we talk about tropes and we decide that they're not actually tropes, because I just think enemies to lovers is like a really big bucket. Like you have both like office enemies and like warring factions enemies. Mm-hmm. And then how is it working here?
I've said for years that my number one enemy is Brett that works at the Valero in Dallas, Texas. So I refuse to believe that people can't be your enemy for a minor slight. My number two enemy is Anthony Bridgerton, fictional character Anthony Bridgerton. I'm not his number one enemy either because he's not real. And also that would be bees, I think. Yeah. but yeah, I think people need to have a better imagination when it comes to enemies. Because like if I can't have an enemy, like I'm not in a decades-long dueling war with somebody. I've tried, but like I let the people have enemies. That's all I'm saying. But like what's interesting about this is, so Emma kind of like alluded to this earlier, but what's like kind of interesting about the enemies to lovers in this book is that it overlaps with friends to lovers and second chance romance. So it doesn't really like neatly fit all of them, although I think enemies to lovers is definitely the strongest out of the three. Because like the romance was just blossoming before, and then there's a friends to lovers to one of us is a ghost to lovers. No, friends to enemies to one of us is a ghost to lovers. There's the longer path. When people talk about enemies to lovers, they're like they have to be in a years-long family feud or actively trying to kill each other, like we were kind of talking about earlier. And I think that's a reaction to people not liking contemporary romances that are labeled enemies to lovers, like those office romances, because they think the stakes aren't high enough. I actually don't think enemies to lovers needs to be high stakes. I think it needs to be high emotion. Like you need to understand why they hate each other, and there needs to be a palpable shift in attitude. Like less skilled authors will just use banter to signal that characters dislike each other, but the problem with that is that it reads like flirtation. So instead of getting enemies to lovers, you're getting like, wow, the vibe in marketing is weirdly charged today.
No, I really like that. I think you exactly diagnosed what people are talking about. It is frustrating, and people will say like if they're not trying to kill each other, like I don't believe it's enemies to lovers, but I think that shortchanges modern relationships. And like, I think Enemies to Lovers kind of tracks the changes a relationship can take. Like sometimes you don't always like each other. Maybe something bad really happens between the two of you, or maybe it's at the start of the relationship and you both don't see each other correctly. Like maybe one person is assuming like worse attributes about the other person. And I still think that's high stakes. Like, wouldn't you feel terrible if like, yeah, when I first met you, I thought you were kind of a bitch. Like, you wouldn't feel great, right? Like, I don't know. I feel like my first impression of a lot of people often doesn't even really match up with who they are. Like, it's just impossible to really know someone until you get to know them. And I think Enemies to Lovers is like a good way to explore that tension.
I like in this book that I think a frequent, at least in historical romances that I enjoy, sort of edit of the trope is enemies to lovers, but he's been secretly in love with her the whole time. And he's like aware of his feelings. Yep. Like that is,
ruined by rumor.
Like there's so many books that I enjoy like that. Like there's been a miscommunication. She assumes that he's thinking the worst of her, but actually he has like great affection for her. I love those books. But I think in this book, Valerian does have this sort of fixation on Abigail. But I think if you asked him at any point leading up to him being a ghost, he was like, I hate Abigail. Like he's not in touch with his feelings towards her. He really does feel this betrayal very acutely. So it feels more like equitable. And I think Abigail also knows she can like look at the circumstance of their falling out and interpret it as he did and be like, I really hurt him. And also I don't have the opportunity to explain to him what happened, even though it's a miscommunication and she wasn't really trying to hurt him. She's not holding anything against him. She's just like, she's powerless to correct his perception of it. And then also he's continued to hurt her for the years intervening and sort of keep her in her place in the Tann, which is like the sort of natural reaction to the betrayal that he feels. So I think it gets that like high stakes thing, and it's not a reveal like, oh, I've been in love with you for years, and I've been like not telling you about it. He's been in love with her for years and has had no idea.
It's funny though, because don't like all his friends kind of know? Like doesn't he like scare his friends away from like?
Yes.
Yeah. So, which is lying to himself, like I'm doing this to be mean to her, but really. It's for my own gratification.
And nobody realizes that I'm like obsessed with her. And they're like, we all knew, which leads to some of my favorite scenes. Like when he's at the ball, they keep going. They go to like 7 balls in this book, and each subsequent ball, more of the friends like try to sort of flirt with Abigail. They're like, oh, like Valerian's been gone for a few days. Like maybe I can get like my chance like, to get with Abigail. Now, yeah. And he just increasingly has like more like petulant responses. And he's like stomping his feet. It's like, ah, it's very cute. So still on the subject of their relationship, I think this is true across Mallory, and we've sort of hinted at this. I think that a trait of Mallory is chemistry between couples. I will put up with her kookiest plots, like plots that I can't comprehend what's going on, because I'm always so invested in her couples. So what makes a Mallory pairing special? Amongst the books you've read, is there something that unites her couples or characters? What makes a Mallory pairing a Mallory pairing, and like why does it work so well?
I don't even know if my point is very comprehensible, but we'll go down this path together. I find a lot of similarity between Anne Mallory and Sherry Thomas, where like what I think of first is like the chemistry they build between the couples and like relationship building scenes. Like we mentioned earlier, she's much more like show. Like she shows the couple being together. Like she kind of creates a why for maybe why these characters would like each other, like what their beef is. And I think it's a little different from like the individuality of their characters. I wouldn't even say Anne Mallory's characters are that different from each other. I don't know if you guys like agree, disagree with that. I would put like Mary Balog as like someone who creates really unique characters. Like I feel very different. But this kind of circled Twitter a few days ago, or maybe it was just one tweet I saw that Bailey sent to me.
Bailey at the scene of the crime.
Yeah. This is how you start discourse. You're like, know, this is a topic. And you're like, no, just one tweet.
It was just one tweet. But it was the author, Rebecca Weatherspoon. She just said a lot of romance writers are not showing romantic scenes or like reasons why couples would like each other. And I think as we were talking about Enemies to Lovers is especially like prone to this, where it's like the author is hitting the antagonistic beats, but either they're not being mean enough, or maybe I just don't believe like why they're being antagonistic.
But yeah, I think sometimes they hold back. You don't want to like you want them to be too mean, because then you're worried about the reader losing empathy. Losing one of the characters. Yeah,
yeah. But I feel like if an author does a good enough job, like, I can kind of see both viewpoints, even if I'm, like, frustrated with one of the characters. But I feel like what makes an Anne Mallory couple her, like, an Anne Mallory couple is very charged scenes. Like, in One Night is Never Enough, the chess scene, I feel like it's, like, very, like, stereotypical of her, where it's, like, I don't want to relay the plot of this book, but the sex is kind of like looming in the background and it feels inevitable because that's why she's there at the house. The female main character is there because like she's going to have sex with the male main character, but they just have chess instead. And then he doesn't. He's like, no, we're not going to have sex. And I was like, but this was very charged. Like, I don't think you guys needed to be together. Yeah, so she has these scenes pretty frequently. And in this book, it's a lot of time they spend together and kind of alluding to their past. Like we talked about before, like we don't get a lot of information. And we don't even know like the big thing that broke them, I think almost till the end. Like it's like close to the end of the book.
Yeah.
Also, I kind of get annoyed with writers that assume that they're building tension by telling me that a charged look has happened or like one character is like having horny thoughts, but it's only horny thoughts. if that makes sense, I feel like it can convey like a change within the character. Like maybe they never saw that character in that way, but it, I feel like does not build sexual tension, or it often doesn't.
No, I totally agree with you. I think like I feel like it's kind of bad romance writing to just be like, oh, he is so attractive, and then I'm, and just be like reiterating that over and over and over in your head. Mm-hmm. Anne Mallory is also like, I think this is something that like Emma's talked to us about offline a few times. Is like Anne Mallory is really not interested in what people look like at all.
Yeah.
Like you won't.
Right.
Really
like get- you have no idea how tall anyone is. Sometimes I forget what hair color people have. Like. Yeah. It just, she's not doing that. But like, there's no way that you would think that these books are not like horny. Like they're definitely horny for each other, despite not describing each other's bodies.
Yeah. And I think that's so cool. And that's kind of like, and I wouldn't say that like people should not describe, because then like Cherry Thomas describes how people look like in great detail. And I love that so much. But also Cherry Thomas is like, her writing is really horny. Like, I don't know. Like compliment. Like, it kind of makes you think like, oh, what could people be doing? Like if they were kind of like focusing on like a different aspect of craft instead of trying to convince the reader that both characters are hot and or hot for each other. So for this book, I knew I was reading something special from the opening scene where Valerian and Abigail are circling each other and they're insulting each other. Like, I'm going to read you some dialogue. It's so good. So Valerian says, "Fancy a crazed woman with a mother who is nearly a leper, one social finger falling off at a time? Do you think yourself enough of a catch? Your beauty, charms, and spirit so great that I would even deign to breathe in the same space as you?" And then Abigail says, "Is that so, your lordship? And yet here you are, breathing my air, coming closer to inhale more." So he's
so hard.
I know, it's so good. So he's getting in some sly digs about her seeing ghosts with the emphasis on spirit, but more importantly, like, that was very hot.
And they don't think anyone's noticing. They're like, this in private. This is, nobody's like noticing us bantering in the corner together.
Yeah, this is very private. And then also, again, for this book, Mallory does so much with physical touch. So we've already kind of talked about like how she doesn't really care so much about what people look like, but like the tactile things like was kind of what makes this book what it is. So we learn at the end that Abigail's mother has been withholding physical affection at the advice of the evil doctor. But something that we learn much, much earlier is that Valerian, even in full bully mode, will find a way to surreptitiously touch Abigail, both for his own gratification and to torment her. Valerian in ghost mode goes through different stages of being able to touch, but he's only ever able to touch Abigail. When he disappears for the first time and she finds him at his family's house, there's this really raw emotional moment where she can't overtly acknowledge him because she's in a room with other people. But Valerian is desperately happy to see her again and discovers that he's able to touch her for the first time. So he, as a ghost, is petting her dress and stroking her cheek and touching her hair. Abigail is trying to keep it together, but this is something that she's wanted for so long, and she's overwhelmed at receiving it from the last person she thought would ever acknowledge her again. Valerian's ability to touch Abigail gradually gets stronger, but he also tells her at one point that it's like touching her through a glove. So this is why I think Ghost Valerian isn't eligible for the HEA. There's a sense of wrongness that doesn't keep them from physical intimacy. There are some really, really great scenes in this book I think we'll talk about a little bit later, but kind of slots the love scenes more thoroughly as part of the emotional journey of the characters than anything else.
Yeah, I love the dialogue you included, because that's one of the things, like, I think if I was, like, when I'm describing the plot of this book, it's hard, unless you're reading the book, to understand, like, what he means by spirit. Mm-hmm. You're like, especially when you're reading it the first time, it's like, Abigail reacts to that word, she acknowledges a reaction to that word, but we don't know what it means yet. And then when you read it again, once you know that she can see ghost, it's like, oh, he's referencing, so he's doing this dig at her, but Anne Mallory doesn't explain it. It's not like, she doesn't explain. Abigail's like, oh, that word, because I can see ghost. Like, you just have to pick up on all these little clues in how they speak to each other. And that's true for across characters. Like, lots of characters will reference something to the side and you just have to pick up on it. Or, like, if you don't, other clues will sort of clue you into, like, what's going on overall. And I feel like every time I've read this book, I've noticed different connections between how characters reveal information to each other, which is also very, like, true to life. Like, it feels very, like, sometimes you get pieces of information that you don't know what to do with or you don't know their meaning. That's just the nature of, like, communicating with people. So when I was reading this book, especially this time, I noticed some elements that reminded me kind of YA. I'm not really a YA guy, and I wasn't even really when I was a teen, so I've definitely read fewer of these books than probably the average reader. But the way that the characters interacted with each other, especially sort of the cliques amongst the Tawn and all those coded relationships that are meaningful to some members and not to others, really reminded me sort of how you would structure, like, a high school story where they're different in-groups, out-groups. I don't think I see this very often in romance. The secondary characters here are not set up for their own romances, which is something that I think we've all sort of started to enjoy more and more and appreciate more and more as people get into, like, sort of series structures. All these characters have their own lives, so we're not just dealing with, like, a coterie of chestnut-haired Bridgertons. I think this is one of those things that makes Mallory work, despite some of the wallpaperness. It reminds me a little of Gaffney and Wickerly series, though clearly on a smaller scale, where Gaffney has lots of side characters that have, you have the sense that they have their own lives that we may or may not be privy to in sort of the realm of Wickerly.
I agree with that. I do like that you related it to high school, because I feel like that's a more accurate descriptor of the Tun. I feel like other wallpapers will treat the Tun as, like, important people who deserve their money and sometimes still care about poor people. I think Anne Mallory's depiction might be closer, where it's a lot of people motivated by different factors, and those factors are more about gaining money and social standing. And yeah, like you mentioned, Mallory seems much more invested in making her current book work, and although her plots are convoluted, as we've been talking about, you can tell she's trying to make it work. But yeah, more high school dynamics among the Tun, please.
Yeah, it's like, they're so young, it makes sense that they're not, like, fully formed grown-ups and also indulge in sort of the pettiness of, like, cliques. Like, I don't know why there aren't more cliques in the Tawn in depictions and historical romance. I feel like anytime you have people, like, vying for romantic affection or any sort of power, like, cliques are going to form. But I feel like you don't see that often, these sort of, like, codified groups that have, like, an in-group and out-group. And, like, when they meet, like, conflict happens.
Well, you do get, like, bullies, like Cressida and Bridgerton is, like, the series bully. I think kind of, like, what makes Mallory different here is that Mallory isn't just like, oh, here's the bully group. Like, you kind of get an easier idea of, like, how they interact with each other and, like, how they would interact apart from each other. Because, like, Campbell with Valerian is very different than Campbell on his own. I think Anne Mallory kind of has, like, a better understanding of people's reasonings behind the way that they behave and how, like, you can, being in a group will, like, influence your thinking than something similar to be like, oh, this is the bad guy. This is the guy we don't like.
And you talked about her, how she writes male characters. I think there are a few different books that I think this happens in where I think some, like you mentioned Cressida and Bridgerton, I think often there's, like, conflict between women in sort of social groups. Right. But I think she's good at writing, like, men having, like, a relationship and having conflict or, like, different, acknowledging that they have different needs. I'm thinking about the brothers in One Night Is Never Enough and the one that comes after that. What's it called? Something?
Seven something.
No, it's the one where she.
Oh, the Crazy Grumpy Sunshine.
Yes.
That's all I call it in my mind.
She's a series where they're two brothers, and the brothers have very different motivations. And I think it feels very organic and, like, natural for their relationship, which I feel like is not always depicted well in when two men are friends or at odds with each other.
Mm-hmm. I think she could have easily also made the mom just, like, bad, but she does, like, give her a backstory and like a why, and I still don't really like her mom, but she's like a more fleshed out character than I think she might have ended up being.
There's so many villains, but they have lots of different motivating factors for like why they betray Valerian and Abigail on different scales.
In my mind, Valerian is James Spader in Pretty in Pink. Like, he's like the ultimate hot bully with a quick wit. Like, when people are like, oh, I don't understand the appeal of bully romance, like when they're being rude, I'm like, have you seen Pretty in Pink? Like, does that help? Like, I do think there's also kind of like a different sense of scope for like the cliquish and bullying behavior and for the Earl's pleasure. Like, there would be moments when Abigail would notice that they're all circling her and she's like really bracing for something awful to happen in a way that kind of like made you as the reader be like actually like kind of scared. I also like how it would be so easy to write it as something as simple as Valerian thought Abigail was telling a hurtful lie, so that's why his behavior toward her changed. But Mallory doesn't really make it quite that straightforward. So like the first change is Valerian going to school at Eton and realizing that his earnest affection for Abigail is something to be embarrassed by. Like, he buys Abigail a hairbrush that she ends up keeping and treasuring, and he is humiliated because one of his friends, who we later learn is Campbell, is giving him a hard time about it. So he's moved to an entirely new circle that Abigail doesn't really fit in with, and he's at the age where he's not confident enough to not care. And also, like, not for purely romantic reasons, but Campbell ends up pursuing Abigail when Valerian is out of commission. So Valerian is even just like, what the hell, man? Like, what is the point of these groups?
Not until this moment did I think about, like, if they hadn't had the conflict with the brother, with the ghost brother, that leads to their falling out, like, what would have happened between Valerian and Abigail? And it's like, they still might have had a falling out because Valerian's parents, or his father and his grandmother, don't like Abigail. They seem less interested in him, like, keeping away from her when he's the second son, but they don't ever like her. And also, he's malleable to the point where he could be convinced by his friends when he's less powerful because he's the second son to sort of do away with his relationship. And so because they have this big falling out and he's so hurt by it, it's almost like he stays like aware of her for longer. Like, he never, like, he doesn't, it's not a slow fade. So he doesn't just like ghost her. he literally ghosts her later. And so it almost like it extends their relationship because of this like cataclysmic event between the two of them. But yeah, but if without even the ghost factor of like the betrayal, they could still not work out because of their like sort of difference in social class, and also Valerian's like lack of confidence in pursuing her, even though he has like this great affection for her. So there is another plot. Man, Mallory stuffs so much plot in this, but Abigail is a fraud. Like, her family is not, their last name is not actually Smart. Her mom has been lying about their background so that Abigail can get this entry into the Ton and marry a noble person. So this is another in sort of our canon of fraud is romantic, with Unmasked by the Marquis and The Ruin of Evangeline Jones. I love that Valerian thinks Abigail is one kind of fraud, lying about her ghostly visions to be cruel, when actually she is lying along with her mother about her family's origins to try and get into the Ton. It makes her anxiety about the relationship really palpable, and you can see like why she is so scared of telling him the truth, because she knows how he's reacted when he thought she was lying before to sort of manipulate or control people. So related to the fraud are two things that I think Mallory does really well, in spite of being wallpapery, is that she doesn't assume information travels as fast as it does now, which I think is a problem in a lot of historical romances. Like, people will just know something very quickly. This also comes up in The Earl I Ruined. I think that that book handles like information sharing really well. A few of Mallory's plots involve things being public knowledge without one person knowing it yet, which makes sense because there's not a 24-hour gossip cycle in the Regency. And I think she does a good job of showing people not quite fitting into the coded world of the Ton. Abigail's mother is always just a little bit off socially, and I think we're used to seeing characters who either know the rules and fit into them well or want to rebuke them. But I like when characters want to fit in really badly and just can't because the rules are not bred into them.
This is my second time reading this book, and I was a bit surprised by how much darker it was than I remembered. Like, the fraud is deployed here kind of as a survival mechanism, like in The Ruin of Evangeline Jones. In Evangeline Jones, Evie has a mentor that steers her into this life of being a fraudulent medium, but he doesn't have her best interests at heart and is blasé about the consequences that she could face if she keeps upping the ante. This is kind of similar to Abigail's mother, who has commandeered the Smart family name to push her daughter into the Ton, while she also knows that the Ton has a level of scrutiny that could provide disastrous for her daughter, who has similar supernatural powers that she needs to keep hidden. So there's this very real threat of incarceration or assault if Abigail isn't able to fit into the Ton. Her mother brings in the doctor to, like, quote-unquote, cure her after Mrs. Browning, the companion, starts asking questions about Abigail's behavior. So Abigail is also worried about what Valerian could do to her if he has this, like, list of Ton secrets, while also knowing that he could tell people about her ability to see ghosts and get her more thoroughly ostracized at any moment. I think this is something that's very important for Ghost Valerian. I like how I keep differentiating between the two. He always knew that he could move in the world differently than her. Abigail calls herself a gnat to his social Goliath. But in order for her to help him find his body, she has to walk a very delicate line and not behaving so oddly that she's going to get punished. This is near impossible to do when you have a cranky ghost yelling at you all the time. And sleuthing for a missing body is not something that delicate ladies of the Ton are wont to do. So, like, the stakes are very high. It's, like, a very dangerous sort of situation that I think kind of, like, adds to kind of the darkness of the fraud in this book.
I don't have a comment on the fraud, just on your last part, Charles, where it's like Valerian has the opportunity to watch Abigail, like, move through the world. And so he'll, like, ask her to do things. And she's like, I can't just go to, like, this gaming hell. Like, that's what... But also I think it provides him an opportunity to, like, obviously by his very presence, people would change how they act. Like, if Valerian's there standing with Abigail, they're going to act differently. But because he's not actually there, like, they can't see that he's there, he can see how people treat her. And mm-hmm. I think that's kind of important to their relationship and how it develops.
Like, when he's watching her mother and Mrs. Browning, yes, like, berate her in the carriage and being, yeah, like, oh, you're not very pretty. Oh, you're not doing this right. And he's just like, why do you put up with this? And you're just like, you're an heir to a duke. Like, nobody talks to you like this.
Yeah.
And he's thought that she's a social climber like her mother for so long. He can't conceptualize that maybe he's doing it. She's sort of going along with her mother because there's this threat of incarceration. There's this threat of asylum that if she doesn't go along with what her mother wants, that the doctor's going to come back. He just thinks that Abigail is, because it goes along with his perception of her betrayal of him, that she's doing the same thing. She wants to marry wealthy. And so when he's like, I think a reader who's like, or an author who's not as like attuned to that, like, could write Valerian sort of keeping people away from Abigail as like a strictly cruel behavior. Like, it's one of those things that's like almost like an unforgivable act for some characters where, like, that's really controlling and manipulative to, like, prevent her from getting married because you have this, like, fixation on her. But I think he could also justify it to himself. He's like, she's a upstart. Like, she's trying to marry these people because of their, like, the power it will give her, because I see her as a social climber. He can justify it to himself that way. And so, like, for every bad action, even, like, for the villains, I think there's, like, the subtlety to it, whether they're, like, in having trauma or there's some sort of misperception on their part of, like, why they need to act this way, not to necessarily make it justified, but to explain it.
Well, it's like the K.J. Charles approach. Like, why would someone be a social climber? Mm-hmm. Like, if he's – we all do this where it's like, if someone wrongs you, then I assume more nefarious intentions on that person's part than is probably there. But yeah, it's like an intellectual exercise to, like, actually think through, like, why, what does this person stand to gain? Like, do they don't have the social security that he does? But yeah, I don't have much beyond that. I feel like this is the KJ Charles approach.
So speaking of, like, bad behavior, I love Beth's Goodreads review of it, of the book. So she said, my favorite thing about Anne Mallory is that with every villain reveal, I'm like, who is that again? There are so many characters that all have bad acts in this. It takes a while to figure out who the actual villain is, but there are lots of people who are sort of involved in the plot, and maybe they don't know the level of, like, involvement in the plot they have. Sir Walter sort of comes out of nowhere as the person who's, like, actually kidnapping Valerian. But for all our character work, the reveals of who the villains are a little bit like, who? This may have been the most daunting plot summary I've ever written, because a Mallory book, they're kind of just strung together by vibes. We know this. The things that I remember about a Mallory book are almost never the plot, instead little gestures of intimacy. I honestly have no idea who the villain is in One Night Is Never Enough, a book I've read maybe 6 times, but I sell it to people based on a moment that happens with a bobby pin. This book has lots of those too. I always think of Ghost Valerian having a temper tantrum right behind Abigail's dancing party partner when she suddenly becomes available because Valerian is not discouraging people from giving her attention. I just want to give both of you time to squeal over your favorite moments in this book.
I did say the opening scene was one of my favorites, so I'm glad Charles like read a bit of the dialogue because it is just so pitch perfect. Also, when they have sex in public, I will say that's like a very memorable scene too. Like, so they're at a racetrack and it's like, he's like getting her off in time to like the audience kind of like getting louder. So it's like kind of muffled, but it felt like such a cinematic scene. Like Emma was talking about this being a movie. I'm like, I could see this in a movie. Like this would be such like an interesting scene, I think.
Yeah, for all of Mallory's like lack of description, I really feel like I can visualize so many of her scenes so well.
Yeah, I have a really good picture of it. Okay, so for me, Valerian becoming a ghost reveals just how much power he had in getting people to back off Abigail, because suddenly she becomes an appealing prospect again to Valerian's friends. And he has so many ghost tantrums when Abigail would dance with like Campbell or Pinchard. And we don't really get to hear the full diatribes, but knowing that he's always, but Abigail is like, oh, he's always insulting their parentage. That was just very, very funny to me. Like, that's something the heir to a dukedom would have at the ready as an insult. And yeah, I have a similar experience with Mallory. Like, I actually have a really good memory for plots. And if I've enjoyed the book, I can usually talk about it long after I've read it. But for Mallory, it's like those like little small moments that I remember. I remember Valerian's temper tantrums. I remembered them circling each other at the beginning. Couldn't for the life of me tell you who kidnapped Valerian or why Valerian was beefing with Abigail in the first place.
Like, I always think about the hairbrush. Like, I think the first few times I read this, like, the hairbrush reveal. Like, what's nice about Valerian, and I think Valerie uses this to her advantage because the plot is so confusing. Valerian as a ghost, like, has struggles with his memory. So sometimes he will, like, see something and it will jog a memory for him. And so it kind of, you're in line with Valerian because the reader also doesn't know all the information. So he's been in Abigail's room a ton, but then he sees her, like, sort of playing with the handle of her hairbrush. And he's like, the hairbrush, like, I gave her that hairbrush. And it, like, sort of jolts him back to memory and like grounds him. And he's like, I remember the circumstances of that hairbrush. Like this is this like symbol of our relationship together. And it feels very like that's the thing I remember is like that feeling of realizing that Valerian knows what the hairbrush is and has been thinking about it. And he has the comb in his closet still. Like it's so good. Okay. Do we want to talk about ghost sex? We can. I just think that the mechanics of it are very interesting. I think all the sex scenes, actually, I don't think we actually see them have sex when he's a person.
No.
So he's continually sort of developing the skill of being able to touch Abigail. And at first it feels sort of like a whisper, and then it feels like a hand, like a glove touch on his hand. Glove. Yeah. And then it's like eventually they're able, like when they finally have sex, it seems like they're actually having sex. Like I don't think either of them are experiencing sort of any like veil. And it's almost like as they get more emotionally connected, he's able to touch her more readily. And I think that's sort of like mechanics of it. Because I think historical romance, I mean, I only read historical romance, so I can't speak for the whole genre. But I think they're really interested in like the mechanics of sex, like negotiating, like, what are we allowed to do? What are we, what can we do without you getting ruined? And because he's a ghost, that's like not really a question. Like, I don't think there are no qualms about him having like penetrative sex with her because they're just both like so excited that they can do that because he's able to touch her now.
It doesn't count if he's a ghost.
Right.
He can get a
pregnant.
It's fine.
Obviously it feels novel because I've never read a historical romance where someone is a ghost having sex before. But I just love that Mallory's like asking different questions because I think it also makes Abigail, who's very shy and sort of scared of Valerian and scared of the consequences, she ends up becoming very sort of proactive because I think the more engaged she is with him, the more able he's able to be present with her, like as a ghost. Like she's the one who's sort of like asking him to touch her, and he's like, can I even do that? Like, how's this gonna work? And she's sort of pushing the interaction together.
Yeah, he can't seduce her. Like here, like he's kind of joking, like at the beginning where he's like thinks that it's a dream. He's like, if this is a dream, I'd have you on the floor, or like why can't I be like having sex with you? This is very boring. This is not what I would be dreaming. Right. but he can't, like, Valerian literally cannot seduce Abigail, and so because like he finds out, like the way that Mallory writes it is that like he can touch her skin, but he can't really touch her clothes for very long. So mm-hmm. he can't like untie her or like unbutton or something. So like it can't really work as a seduction in like the normal way, because like he can't mm-hmm. just like overwhelm her and then get her undressed. Like he has right. to have Abigail's buy-in. Like if Abigail's going to take off her shift, it's something that like Abigail wants to do. Mm-hmm. So that kind of like makes the love scenes like a lot more charged. I think like at least that one in specific that I'm referencing. I think there's like another one where like Abigail gives him a blowjob, and then he like fingers her in at the hobby horse race. Which, what a sentence.
Also, I said this in the plot. I will say this, and I said this in the plot summary. But the hobby horse, I learned because I Googled it. I was picturing men with sticks with like horses on their heads, but it's a bicycle. Which makes so much more sense. Is this something that people did? Did people like have hobby horses and they like ran? I was like, this
How
is,
whimsical.
I've heard this so many times. It's like, this is such a weird thing. Did Mallory make this up? It's a name for a specific type of bicycle. It's like, oh, but I don't think that's ever clear in the book. It could be horses. I mean, maybe it is sticks with horses' heads on them.
It is what it is. I feel like, Emma, you've talked about this in the past with historical romance, where it's like the baseball diamond of like,
yes,
being the sexual and like penetration is like the last like mm-hmm. that they get to. So it's kind of like an, I don't know if this makes sense, but just like you want there to be like an evolution to the sexual relationship. And so it's like an more interesting way to do it is like how long he can touch her, like what she consents to, like as the relationship grows, then the supernatural aspect kind of changes along with them.
Yeah. And it's like, I think they get to this intimacy quicker because he thinks she's dreaming for the first part. And he's like, if I'm going to be dreaming, I'm going to be touching Abigail. And then she thinks he's fully dead and a ghost. And she's like, well, in her experience, ghosts are kind of horny. So she's like, he's just going to do this till he leaves. So they sort of get to this part where he's like constantly touching her. He's like stroking her neck and like sort of grabbing her waist even before they really talk about their emotions. And they just sort of accept it because she's like, this is what ghosts do. And I think that sort of intimacy, and then the moment when he kisses her, where it feels like this decision, and it's so odd because frequently a kiss is like the first sort of touch that people have in a Regency romance, but this kiss is the first one that feels like a decision instead of a compulsion. And so even though they've been touching each other, or he's been touching her this whole time, like very intimately, it's like this big moment, which I think is the kind of thing that only like Mallory can pull off, where like a first kiss, even though they've been touched before, feels like all of a sudden. It's so good. Thank you so much for listening to Reformed Rakes. If you enjoy the podcast, you can find bonus content on our Patreon at patreon.com/reformedrakes. Please rate and review us on Apple and Spotify. It helps a lot. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram for show updates. The username for both is @reformedrakes. Thank you again, and we'll see you next time.